Hi, everybody. Welcome to Drishti Talk. We're going to be talking today about India's nuclear program with Bhushan Shah. It is Wednesday, September 5. I want to start with a little bit of follow-up first. On episode 106, we were talking about India and China and various factors affecting the rather complicated relationship they share. We specifically focused on the Doklam standoff. And so by way of update, on the 28th of August, the Doklam standoff came to an end. Both governments announced that they were withdrawing from the positions of the standoff and restoring a status quo. India has, as a result, stood down her troops, while China has thereafter removed construction equipment and its claim at the moment to construct any roads in the Bhutanese disputed territory.
On the date which you mentioned, the Indian Ministry of External Affairs just issued a two-point statement on this, that an agreement has been reached. Both the sides have agreed to withdraw the troops. But see, the funny thing, even though China has agreed to withdraw its troops, the Chinese media still continues to spread misinformation that it is India who has first unilaterally withdrawn its troops, leading to an end to the standoff. So it's like the Chinese media and the Chinese government have still not learned their lesson, it seems.
We were listening to a lot of this come out from Chinese media. We've seen some of it even quoted in Indian media over the last week or so. But you also listen to a lot of Indian defense experts, and they're pretty unanimous in how they feel about the outcome. But I think if we look at it purely from a factual standpoint, China's goal in this situation was to construct road in this territory. And the fact that they are now not doing so, not only that, but they, you know, post the statement that you mentioned that came out from the MEA and the relevant statement that came out from China thereafter, a subsequent update came out, I think it was sometime in the evening of the same day, where India confirmed that China has withdrawn its construction troops, and then there was a further update about it. So I think at the end of the day, the fact that China is not constructing road in this territory pretty much signaled, the stand. It was really that unilateral. Then India standing its troops down would have implied China would have just gone ahead and done it immediately, right?
Yeah, and another point to be noted is that throughout the standoff, China always held that for any talks to progress, India has to unilaterally withdraw its troops first. But now the agreement that has been reached just says that in spite of China saying that the talks will not take place unless India withdraws its troops, the talks were actually going on. So you can see the huge difference between what Chinese media and the Chinese government says versus what is actual ground reality. And yeah, another thing is the after effects of the Doklam standoff seem to be continuing in the BRICS 2017 summit, which is being held in Xi'an in China. It is simply unbelievable that China has allowed the names of Pakistan-based terrorist groups to enter the Xiamen Declaration.
It is very interesting. The fact that this agreement was reached roughly a week before the summit was about to begin, considering that the standoff had been going on, I think it was 70 plus days, it was 78 if I'm right or something. So the fact that a week before the BRICS summit was about to be held, this understanding was finally reached, status quo was restored. You know, construction is not going to happen, and India is very happy to stand down if there's not going to be any wrongdoing. Following which, if you look at how the BRICS has been playing out, obviously the five countries involved, had productive meetings. But as you mentioned, the declaration where China is a signatory to some of the concerns India has, especially with regards to terror, where China has so far been taking either a neutral or an opposing vote. And then you have to look at the fact that India and China had a bilateral meeting where numerous items were discussed, but it does look as though not only is China understanding the position that India is putting down, but is also amenable to agreeing with India on other items. The Foreign Secretary's statement after the bilateral was that the Doklam issue wasn't really on the table. It was not discussed in depth, implying that, it's both countries are looking at it as saying, okay, look, we've had that issue. Let's put it aside. Let's move on to other things that we need to discuss. We've seen a lot of the commentary around these issues that, we can't trust that they won't do this again. Maybe they'll try somewhere else. All of which is fine. But But I think it's important to understand, or it looks like China is at least understanding that it's not going to be just a cakewalk. And whether it's militarily, whether it's diplomacy, whether it's things like BRICS, where India is really driving a lot of the agenda.
Yeah, and now the change in India-China relations will be visible for a long time to come, I think. China will no longer consider India as a country which can be easily bullied, but rather view it with some sort of respect.
For anybody that is really interested in understanding more about the after effects, especially now that the standoff is done and we've had the BRICS summit, I'll link in the show notes to a show on Doordarshan that comes up every week, where security experts discuss different matters, and obviously they've been talking about China. I think it's worthwhile listening to that. Yeah, as always, I want to take a minute to thank our listeners for all the valuable feedback we keep getting, topic suggestions, guest suggestions. As always, you can reach us on both Twitter and Facebook at Ek Drishti, and all our episodes, the show notes, comments, and so on can be accessed at the podcast webpage talk.ekdrishti.in. Okay, we're going to jump into our main topic, and we want to discuss today a little bit about the nuclear program in India. Let's put some context as always. In 2014, India's nuclear capacity was about 4,700 megawatts. This has gone up by about 2 gigawatts. So we are now at 6,780 as of 2017, with 22 nuclear generation plants. What is a painful statistic here, though, is that the father of India's nuclear program, Homi Bhabha, who was a fantastic nuclear scientist, he had predicted and planned that India's nuclear capacity would be 8,000 megawatts by 1980. And all we've been able to get at is we have reached maybe about 80% of the capacity, and it's 2017. Currently under construction are 6,700 megawatts worth of nuclear generation plants, which are all expected to be completed somewhere around 2022. Additionally, about 7,000 megawatt capacity has been approved this year for construction down the road. We were projecting ourselves at 8,000 in 1980, and we're not even at that capacity now in 2017.
Even now, in around 2012 or 2013, maybe somewhere around that time, the target was revised at 20,000 megawatts up to the year 2020. However, at the speed at which we are currently going, we may be able to achieve only around 50% of the target.
And not just that, but if you look at percentage share, so today India generates just a little over 3% of its electricity targets from nuclear. And we're looking at generating, trying to touch 20-25%, but by the year 2050, while it may be a little unfair to compare it with, the highest rated ones, but you look at a country like France, for example, which is generating 75% of its electricity needs, from nuclear. So there's a huge gap, not necessarily that we'll ever be at 70 or 75%. But we're so far behind. I mean, we're in single digits today. The Indian government's strategy towards nuclear power, I think the closest document we have at the moment, it's a draft energy policy by the Niti Aayog that was up for public comment until the end of July. There is a dedicated nuclear energy section. But again, and this is where some of these numbers are listed.
Since you mentioned France, in France, currently the population is at around 8 crore people. So France has got 60 nuclear reactors for a population of 8 crores. Now, comparatively, I have some interesting statistics on India. Currently, an average Indian uses 917 kilowatts of electricity annually, which is definitely far less than the statistics of the developed countries. But if you assume that India will grow at 7% for the next coming years continuously, which is very much likely, then by the year 2060, it is said that the electricity consumption of an average Indian may go to 5,300 kilowatts. And hence, India, which currently generates approximately 284 gigawatts of electricity, may need to generate 1,400 gigawatts of electricity in the year 2060. Currently, this is definitely not possible without nuclear power, because coal has got its limitations, even hydroelectricity has got its limitations. So India will have to expand its nuclear power if it has to have an energy secure future.
and you mentioned coal and hydro, and I'll include solar in there because solar energy is one of the technologies that that India is really pushing heavily today as one of the renewable and renewable forms. And there are constant rumblings, during the course of this year, that India is probably going to ramp down both its production of coal as well as setting up of more mining. In wake of solar energy replacing some of these needs. Before we get into some of the technicalities, for those who are really interested to learn about the science behind nuclear power, nuclear generation, various specifics, including uranium reactors versus thorium reactors and so on, and a lot about like the Indian way of harnessing nuclear power and so on, I will point you out to Kushal Mehra's podcast done with Jaideep Prabhu, who's an expert on nuclear energy. I'm going to link that in the show notes, and I really recommend it's about an hour long breakdown of some of the real technicalities around nuclear power if you're interested. So I want to focus a little bit now on thorium, whatever we're talking about in terms of current nuclear generation as well as the upcoming capacity. These are all the pressurized heavy water reactors that are powered by uranium.
See, now the problem with uranium is that India has got less than 1% of the world's uranium deposits. So if you are to continue with uranium reactors, India has to depend on other countries for energy, and which I think would not be good for us. You know how other countries are very peculiar, means very particular when it comes to nuclear fuel.
And so this is one of the reasons, and we'll come to that in a few minutes, about why India is currently making active, is working really hard with certain countries to try and ramp up our ability to get uranium. Because as you mentioned, it's something that we do not have a lot of. And comparatively, India is estimated to have the world's second highest of the world's total thorium reserves.
It is 32%.
Why is it that despite having so much of this as a natural resource, that we're still so heavily focused on uranium, so much so that earlier this year, we've actually approved the construction of 10 more reactors, 10 more uranium reactors, as opposed to anything thorium-wise. And the reason I bring up thorium as well is because thorium breeder reactors were an integral part of Homi Bhabha's original nuclear program. There were three stages in it, and thorium was one of the three stages. And he envisioned India reaching nuclear power maturity enough that we would reach the stage of using thorium breeder reactors.
Yeah, see, let me point out few advantages which thorium has got over uranium. Like you, first one which you already mentioned is that India already has 32% of the world's thorium resource. So we do not need to depend on other countries. We are next only to Australia. See, thorium reactors are cheaper than the conventional uranium reactors. And one reason behind that is that for uranium, you have to separate the isotopes of uranium. Not all the isotopes of uranium are useful as nuclear fuel. But when it comes to thorium, you do not have to separate the isotopes of thorium. This makes it cheaper. Secondly, thorium reactors are much more safer. Now, Nobel laureate Carlo Rubbia approximates that a ton of thorium could produce as much energy as 200 tons of uranium or 4 million tons of coal. Consequently, far less nuclear waste is generated. More importantly, no isotopes with a half-life of beyond 35 years are present in the waste field from thorium reactors, which reduces storage time considerably. Now, an interesting point with regard to thorium is that the current ruling political party of India, the Bharatiya Janata Party, had specifically mentioned in its 2014 election manifesto that it would encourage the development of thorium as a fuel for nuclear reactors in India.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting because, as you mentioned, I mean, it was specifically called out. At least from what I can tell as of now, it doesn't look like any advancements have been made. And if they are, they're, as we mentioned, really quiet. Also, if you look at the energy policy, we're literally talking about, reaching a point of actual advancement far too many years from now. So I don't know if this is because this has just begun And therefore, between all of the amount of work that has to go into everything from construction to building to testing to disposal of waste and you know, making sure that the whole chain of the process is intact. But recent estimates, including the energy policy, indicate that we'll only realistically be able to look at thorium as a fundamental source maybe as late as 2050.
See, we all might be remembering that in July 2005, there was a nuclear accord with the United States. A month after the accord with the US, on August 25, 2005, at a week-long international conference, the scientists of the Bhabha Atomic Research Center, more famously known as the BARC, I would like to name the scientists, V. Jagannathan and Usha Pal, stated that the BARC had designed the world's safest nuclear reactor after some 7 years of effort. So it may have started in 1998 and continued up to 2005. The scientists unveiled a path-breaking design for a thorium breeder reactor, abbreviated as ATBR, that can produce 600 megawatts of electricity for 2 years with absolutely no refueling and practically no control maneuvers. So you can imagine how cost-effective the thorium reactors can be. What this did is that it extended the core life 2 full years. This is greater than any other nuclear power reactors. The ATBR ran entirely on thorium except for the seed plutonium in the prototype to kickstart things. Thorium is, as we have already discussed, thorium is plentiful in India. But what we have done since 2005 to exploit this is unfortunately absolutely nothing. In the past 10 years since the India-US nuclear deal has been going on, US has not helped us manufacture even a single nuclear reactor. The only country which has helped us manufacture nuclear reactors in these 10 years is Russia, that too at Kundankulam. In that too, even Russia increased the price of the Kundankulam nuclear power plant. So the past 10 years, you can say they have been largely wasted, despite having a huge potential in the thorium-based nuclear reactors. And another interesting fact is that in the 10 years of the UPA government, thorium was not only illegally mined from Tamil Nadu, but also exported illegally to other countries.
Well, unfortunately, there's literally been not much in terms of update since that, since the scam was put out. So we don't really know where, if anything, any investigations might have led. So we're talking about the last 10 years and various things where we look at today, the numbers today and realize that India's nuclear abilities have not reached where they should have. It's almost not possible then to not also point out that over the last decade, going as far back as 1995, India has lost numerous, and I mean numerous, nuclear scientists. Official numbers state that at least 71 nuclear scientists have committed suicide since 1995, and these are government numbers. Other estimates indicate that over 1,700 deaths have occurred in the last two decades. There's really been no conclusion to a lot of the investigation. Some forensic experts indicate that various deaths are still unexplained, have not been ruled in any way. But they all have to do with scientists and engineers involved in the nuclear program who have been found dead, in some cases without fingerprints. And there are literally no clues as to why that would help the police catch any of the culprit. So what's going on here?
Yeah, see, lots of suspicious deaths of Indian scientists have taken place. It is something which started with the father of India's nuclear program, that is Homi Jahangir Bhabha. Even his death was very much suspicious. His plane had crashed on Europe's highest mountain, that is Mount Blanc. And I would like to talk about a few peculiar cases. The first case which I would talk about is a case of nuclear scientist Lokanathan Mahalingam. He was a scientist working at the Kaiga Atomic Power Station located in Karnataka. On 13 June 2009, his death was reported. He was not a very well-known scientist, but on 8th June 2009, he went on a morning walk and never returned. 5 days later, his decomposed body was found in the Kali River. As per reports, although police confirmed it as suicide, his family refused to believe the police theory. The security guards on duty are quoted as saying that they never saw him leaving the campus. Now, another case is of the scientist Uma Narasimha Rao. She was aged 63 and a retired scientist of the Bhabha Atomic Research Center. She committed suicide at her house at Govandi, which is near the Bhabha top atomic research center. Although the police suspect she was suffering from depression, the victim's colleagues said it did not seem so. Another case is that of Ravi Mule. He was an employee of the Nuclear Power Corporation India Limited. He went missing and was later declared murdered. His brother made his own efforts to investigate after police failed to make any headway. Another case is of that of M. Iyer. On February 23, 2010, M. Iyer, an engineer working with the Bapa Atomic Research Center, was found dead in his residence. Police investigations again did not conclude anything, with foreign experts declaring, as in all cases of unexplained deaths, that there were no fingerprints or clues that could help the police identify the culprits. So there are numerous such cases. If anyone wants to know about such cases, we can present a link of the website indiafacts.org, which has got the names of many such scientists whose deaths have been found to be mysterious in nature. All these mysterious deaths point out to highly professional murder techniques, which can only be done by professional intelligence agencies. But this is something, unfortunately, whose complete truth we may never ever know because of the secrecy that is associated with nuclear programs.
Yeah, and I want to point out here as well, I mean, obviously, we don't really have by way of explanation an answer to that. But what is definitely unnerving is that a lot of these deaths don't actually have anything to do with what you would expect to be the cause, such as radiation poisoning or any such thing. I mean, a lot of them have been labeled as suicides today, as you've mentioned, we've gone over. But then a lot of them have been deaths, but they're not, not natural ones. They died before their time. They're not succumb to radiation poisoning and things like that. So there's definitely something bizarre going on. And while the official numbers by the government sometime earlier this year state that 71 nuclear scientists died attributed to suicide between 1995 and 2015, and that there were only two officially declared as murders, it does still not answer the question that what about the remaining deaths and how they've been explained so far.
Yeah, and the large number of such deaths taking place in the past decade and a half, I feel we can relate it to the fact that during this past decade, India's nuclear program could not develop to its potential. So this must definitely be linked to the deaths of our scientists, because without our scientists, our nuclear program definitely cannot develop.
Yeah, there's definitely no doubt there, right? Because there is a hindrance to what I would largely call knowledge transfer when it comes to expanding something that requires decades of research. As you mentioned earlier, when we talked about the thorium breeder reactor, just to build that prototype, it took them 7 years. And such knowledge not being transferred is definitely a hindrance to any nuclear program. So finally, I want to talk a little bit about international cooperation. And so today, India has agreements with 14 different countries relating to nuclear plants. As we've already covered a little bit about the U.S. agreement that was signed way back in 2005. But in the last 3 years, we've really amped on this.
Now it's a common mentality that if you have something which others don't have, if you have something which makes you special, then you would definitely not like others to have that thing. The same logic applies to nuclear weapons. By mid-1960s, five countries of the world had officially developed nuclear weapons. They were US, UK, France, USSR and China. So these five countries definitely did not want other countries in the world to develop nuclear weapons. So what they invented is the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Now this treaty was signed on 1st July 1968. And it became effective on 5th March 1970. And as of now, other than five countries, that is India, Israel, North Korea, South Sudan, and Pakistan, all the countries of the world have signed this. Now this Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty divides the countries of the world into two types, nuclear weapon states and non-nuclear weapon states. Now here is the discriminatory nature of the treaty. The treaty defines nuclear weapon states as those that have built and tested a nuclear device before 1st January 1967. Now these countries are, as I already stated, United States, Russia, United Kingdom, France and China. So if any country develops nuclear weapons after 1st January 1967, it would not be recognized as a nuclear weapons state. So now India is a country which exploded a nuclear bomb in 1974. Besides India, Pakistan, North Korea, Israel, and other countries have exploded nuclear devices after 1st January 1967. So these countries, despite possessing nuclear weapons, are not recognized as a nuclear power. So the central point of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty is countries which are recognized by the NPT as the non-nuclear weapon states agree that they will never ever build or acquire nuclear weapons. The five nuclear weapon states can share the benefits of peaceful nuclear energy, and also the five nuclear weapon states on their part have to pursue nuclear disarmament aimed at ultimate elimination of their nuclear arsenals. But this part of disarmament has definitely not happened. If you check India's stand on the Non-Proliferation Treaty, India has always refused to sign the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Our two neighbors, China and Pakistan, both have nuclear weapons. Now, Pakistan has outrightly not signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty. On the contrary, China is recognized as a nuclear power state. So, if China develops nuclear weapons, there won't be any sorts of restrictions imposed on China by the NPT countries. So, this is the reason why India cannot afford to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty.
So, let's also understand what it means, right? So we do, I mean, it is a discriminatory law, and that's one of the reasons why India has continued to oppose signing the NPT. But what would be the impact? What does India lose by not signing it?
So what happened after the Non-Proliferation Treaty is that in 1974, India blasted its nuclear weapons. So the countries which had signed the NPT felt that the NPT is not very successful in stopping the proliferation, that is stopping the spread of nuclear weapons. So next, what they did is they brought in the NSG, Nuclear Suppliers Group. So now in the Nuclear Suppliers Group, currently there are 48 member countries. Now for the conditions of the Nuclear Suppliers Group are that a member of the Nuclear Suppliers Group cannot do civil nuclear business, that is business for building nuclear reactors and trading in nuclear fuel, etc., with a country that has not signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Secondly, one of the members of the Nuclear Suppliers Group refuses to do business with the non-NSG country. It would mean that all the other members of the Nuclear Suppliers Group cannot do business. So India currently is not a member of this group. And most of the countries having uranium or having technology to build nuclear reactors are members of this group. So which earlier meant that these countries, the members of the Nuclear Suppliers Group, cannot do any business with India with respect to building nuclear reactors and supplying nuclear fuel to India. So this was a situation up till 2008. So whatever we developed up to from the 1950s till 2008 was largely indigenous. Now in 2008, despite not signing the Non-Proliferation Treaty officially, India had adhered to all the terms and conditions of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. After the 1998 nuclear test, we did not conduct any nuclear test. Then we also segregated the nuclear energy for military and civilian use. So in 2008, the NSG agreed to grant India a waiver, which means that now the countries which are members of the NSG can do civil nuclear business with India. So after 2008, if you see, including United States, just like you already mentioned, 14 other countries have signed civil nuclear deals with India. So practically what we lose by not joining the NSG, that we cannot influence the future policies of the NSG directly. Means we will have to do it through our friends in the NSG, that is if at all they agree to us. And number two, NSG is a consensus group. All the 48 countries of the NSG have to accept China has objected to India joining NSG. If in future India manages to join the NSG and China agrees, then any new member which wants to apply to join the NSG has to get India's approval as well. So it cannot afford bad relations with India. For instance, if India is accepted in the NSG and Pakistan now wants to join the NSG next, so Pakistan will have to convince India as well. So this gives India bit more power in international politics.
Yeah, and in fact, one of the things we've seen over the last couple of years with various bilateral and other international visits has been vocal support by a lot of the other countries that you've been talking about, except for China, for India's bid at the NSG. Not just that, but as you mentioned also that, post 2008, because there was a waiver granted and there was this possibility, we've had numerous, nuclear agreements signed. So we had, for example, the nuclear deal with Australia in 2014. India was Australia's first, non-NPT country that they entered into an agreement with. The first shipment of uranium is expected to have arrived in India in July this year. Similarly, Canada had stopped dealing with India in the case of, nuclear fuel and other things. Again, they've committed now to providing India with 3,000 metric tons of uranium over the course of 5 years. And another example I just want to mention quickly is Japan, whom we signed an agreement with last year. Japanese is more on the technology side, so they're going to be helping us with building some of the reactors that are underway over the next decade.
See, Japan signing a civil nuclear deal with us is a very big thing because there is a proverb in Hindi, "Dood ka jala chhas bhi phook phook kar pita hai." So Japan is that dood ka jala when it comes to nuclear weapons. It is practically the only country in modern times to suffer a nuclear attack on its territory. So hence the nuclear issues are a hot political issue in the domestic politics of Japan as well. So despite that, if the Japanese Prime Minister has agreed to sign a nuclear deal with India, then he is definitely taking a political risk at home. This signifies the closeness of the India-Japan relationship.
Yeah, and I think the India-Japan relationship is something that's of unique importance, especially when we look at the Asian politics, China, and everything else. So hopefully we'll try and visit that soon. Okay. One final point, I think, since we're talking about foreign contributions, is that while the government has updated, our the Atomic Energy Act from 1962, any JVs that are done for technical cooperation, will always be done with government of India control, and not through any other means. For example, you have things like FDI, which is actually not permitted in nuclear technology, so you can't do any foreign direct investment. But it has to be done through joint ventures with the government of India. I think that's about it for this episode. We wanted to touch on various aspects of India's nuclear program. I think a little look back at where we started back in the 1950s and where we are today in 2017, and we've not really come close to meeting what was envisioned. That being said, we've also heard about some of the recent improvements, the recent agreements that have been signed in the last couple of years, and some of the targets that have been set, down the road for us. If you look at the next decade, but also all the way up to, the goals that we have for 2050. Remember that India is, a country with growing electricity needs. The government is expected to target individual household electricity somewhere middle of next year. You yourself, Bhushan, you mentioned what is expected to be, individual consumption of electricity if we continue to grow at 7%. And so that plus the fact that we're a signatory to the Paris Agreement, where we are actually committing to controlling emissions and our reliance on fossil fuels, means India needs urgently more and more renewable, more and more clean energy sources. And I think there's little doubt that nuclear is definitely, or should definitely, play a big part in that. Bhushan, as always, please share your Twitter handle for us.
Okay, my Twitter handle is @BHS7ROCKS, R-O-C-K-S.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Bhushan.